Hey, folks, one of today's Ring of Fire radio sponsors is News Voice. You can check them out at newsvoice.com/ring. As you know, news media has become more and more concentrated. And also, because of social media, we tend to live in news bubbles. One of the ways to combat this is a service that I use on a daily basis when I want to know the most I can about each individual story I talk about, News Voice. They bring together articles about news topics from different perspectives, both the right and the left. Now, I'm a little bit jaded, so I read this to find out exactly what kind of lies the right is going to use to combat the reality of the news stories that we see. But your mileage may vary, and at the very least, you'll get a well-rounded picture of any given story. News Voice, it's a website and app for iOS and Android. You can access for free if you go to newsvoice.com/ring. It gives you a personalized news feed by aggregating a mix of mainstream media sources, international sources, and independent media sources. Multiple sources are provided for each news story, so like I say, you get a well-rounded perspective on any given story. The whole site is fueled by crowdsourcing, so you can upvote stories you think are important so more people will see them. You can add stories to the site. You can add a source that's missing for a story. It's meant to be a completely open and democratized source for news that lets you get every side of every story. They also have a video interview series featuring guests from like Chris Hedges to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You can go download the app for free right now by going to newsvoice.com/ring. That's newsvoice.com/ring. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Today on the show, Zoe Carpenter from The Nation magazine will join us to discuss the recent IPCC report on climate change and why time is drastically running out to avoid disastrous levels of global warming. Dahlia Lithwick from Slate will be here to explain why it's up to the other eight justices to save us from Justice Brett Kavanaugh. Heather Digby Parton from Salon will be here to discuss the week's news. And John Raefling, former criminal defense attorney, will join us to talk about the end of cash bail system in California and why the result may leave more people incarcerated. Don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com, sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. And if you want the full show without commercials, become a member. That's the best way to support this program. That's ROFpodcast.com. Here to recap some of the biggest news stories of the week, Heather Parton from Salon, or as you may know her from her blog, Hullabaloo, Digby. So, Heather, it's been a couple of weeks since we have spoken, and the last time that you and I spoke was actually right after the Kavanaugh and Ford hearing. This was before the decision, or I guess the forced decision, where the Republicans had to agree to an FBI vetting of Kavanaugh and the stories and the accusations surrounding him. I think everyone remembers that the FBI investigation was rather incomplete. They interviewed only four witnesses. They did not follow the leads. There are stories after stories of people who were in college with Kavanaugh, who were in high school with Kavanaugh, who had information for the FBI that the FBI simply did not accept, would not sit down with them, would not receive, would not report to the president. That was all part of the program where the FBI investigation was to be a big whitewash. And then ultimately, Susan Collins cast the deciding vote to confirm Kavanaugh. Joe Manchin, a Democrat, took the free vote and ended up voting for him as well. But I think we can talk about whether we think that would have been different had Collins not voted for him. And here we are in the wake of that. Kavanaugh has now officially been sworn on to the Supreme Court of the United States. I don't think he has quite sat down and heard a case yet. There was a case this week that implicates voting rights that was basically punted at a 4-4, but left it to the circuit court decision. We will talk about that. It has big implications for Heidi Heitkamp and the chances of the Democrats holding or capturing the Senate, I should say, in the fall. But let's stop for a moment, and I want to talk about Susan Collins. You wrote a piece this week, "When Susan Collins Gaslit the Nation." Was that the Republican Party's final surrender to Trump? One of the things that has come out of this is the notion of never Trumpers seems to have more or less gone the way of the dodo bird. If you were a never Trumper and you are still a never Trumper in many respects, you may not no longer be a Republican. That seems to be the way you're pitching your books these days. But give me your sense. I mean, was that the moment that when Susan Collins basically decided to rebrand herself? Was that the moment that the party, the Republican Party, and Donald Trump sort of lost any daylight between them?
Well, that's what I thought. I mean, I had, you know, we'd watched this whole thing unfold, of course. Everybody was riveted to the story of, you know, the Kavanaugh hearings and then the FBI investigation, which, as you pointed out, was, you know, something of a sham. And I've got something else to say on that later that has to do with the further ramifications of that particular you know, arrangement that was made between the White House and the Republican Senate and the FBI. But as far as Collins is concerned, I think, you know, we were all waiting. There had been this sort of dance that was going on with Jeff Flake and Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski and Manchin, and they were all speaking in corners, and people were saying they were trading votes and making deals and what have you. And this idea of the, you know, the quote, never Trumpers, or maybe just call it, you know, the independent moderates in the Republican Party, that there still existed this sort of last vestige of some kind of a conscience. And in the past, Lindsey Graham would have been one of those guys, or, mm-hmm. you know, John McCain or whatever. Lindsey Graham turned into a, you know, a vicious, poisonous reptile during this situation. I mean, he was out front and he was fully embracing Trumpism, which is just vicious. He was attacking, you know, rape survivors in the hallway, saying you should have called a cop. You know, I mean, he was horrible, absolutely awful. And so, but, you know, that has been coming for a while. I don't think it was really surprising. But Susan Collins, particularly in this situation with it being an issue about rape survivors and, you know, Me Too and women's rights, which she was supposedly one of the last, you know, defenders in the Republican Party. I think people were, you know, still sort of expecting something from her. And that speech that she gave, highly anticipated, we all knew it was going to be the deciding vote, was basically a sort of a moderate's version of a Trump speech. And she fully went with Trump. Which is that she, that's why I put it that she gaslit the nation, because she portrayed Brett Kavanaugh completely the opposite of what he actually showed himself to be to the nation in that hearing that you and I talked about the last time we were together here. She said he was a mild-mannered, thoughtful, conscientious jurist, and in fact, you know, we saw what he was. He was a threatening, petulant schoolyard bully. And she portrayed him as being the opposite of what we all had seen. In other words, she said, you can believe me or you can believe your lying eyes. And that is Trump. That is the ultimate expression of Trumpism. And for Susan Collins, they put her out there. She willingly, in fact, it seemed eagerly, went out there, said that the protesters that had been protesting at the Senate went along with the entire Republican line on that, that they were all violent and it was an angry mob and, you know, all this. And basically they were all women. I shouldn't say all women. There were plenty of men there, too. But it was led by women, many of them rape survivors themselves, who flew in to protest this. And there's Susan Collins, the moderate protector of women's rights, calling them an angry mob. So she had come. I think that signaled, I think, the final last gasp of the Republican establishment that might have at some point stood up and said no to Donald Trump. I think it's over. It's done. Susan Collins is now just the other side of the coin of Trumpism. She's a woman. She's slightly less crude in her delivery, but the message was exactly the same.
All right. Well, you know, I agree. And I think, and I want to ask you this, and we got to take a break here in a moment. But, you know, it occurs to me that I think this calculation was, I mean, Susan Collins made a conscious decision as to how she was going to brand herself in this era. And if there was any chance within the Republican Party for there to be anyone other than someone who is like a sentence away from talking about Pizzagate, it strikes me. And I want to pose this question to you. We'll have you answer it when we return. And also I want to talk to you about that, what you think the implications of the non-vetting of Brett Kavanaugh will be in future nominations. But it seems to me that with the death of John McCain, Lindsey Graham and Susan Collins made the decision that there is no longer a caucus within the Republican caucus where they can brand themselves as reasonable moderates and reach across the aisle types of folks. And they made their decision to basically join the herd. I want to get your take on that and more when we return. I'm Sam Seder. This is Ring of Fire Radio. Be right back with Heather Part.
62, you take fire. Is anybody out there alive? Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Out on the highway of the dark side of the moon, I got my wheels spinning. Ooh. Can you hear me?
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder here with Heather Digby Parton from Salon. So Digby, at the break, you basically retold the story of Susan Collins' swan song as the supposed moderate. Now, she's still out there trying to, you know, she was trying to, for a couple of days, sort of split the difference. I sort of believe in Blasey Ford, but I don't think that she, you know, she has the right person, which I have to say, and I don't know why we didn't hear more about this, at least the pushback and people who would interview her. If Blasey Ford was wrong about Brett Kavanaugh, Blasey Ford also had to be wrong about Mark Judge and also wrong about PJ and also wrong about her good friend. And she must have been incredibly lucky to have been able to name four people who were literally on Kavanaugh's calendar around the exact same time going to an exact same type of party. I mean, that's pretty stunning stuff. But Susan Collins never had to sort of explain that to anybody. But I wonder what your thoughts are that if Susan Collins and Lindsey Graham were basically made the conscious decision with John McCain dead, that brand of being the sort of maverick, the so-called moderate within the context of the Republican Party, that brand is dead and useless for them electorally and in any other fashion.
Well, they apparently think that. I mean, I feel as if Lindsey Graham is behaving as a man liberated. The death of John McCain obviously has allowed him to be the person he always really wanted to be.
Interesting.
And he is a very calculating politician. So I don't discount what you said either, that they have made a conscious decision to go with Trumpism because that's the way forward electorally. And Graham, you know, there's a lot of talk that he may, you know, be considered to be the replacement for Jeff Sessions. maybe that's my personal theory, that not my personal theory, there are a lot of people who think this, but I agree with it, that Graham may step in and replace Sessions, and then Nikki Haley will be named to Graham's seat in the Senate. She's from South Carolina, too. And then she would be likely to win re-election in 2020, et cetera, et cetera. So in any case, I think Graham has big ambitions. Let's just put it that way. And I think that he has made a calculation. On the other hand, I also think he's really enjoying this. I mean, I've never seen him so energetic and so animated, at least not since he was talking about Monica Lewinsky's orgasms back in the late 90s. You know, one thing I did want to say about the Susan Collins business is that the idea that she didn't, that she believes Blasey Ford, but she doesn't think Blasey Ford had the right attacker. That was a, you know, first of all, that was an idea spun out originally by this Republican operative named Ed Whalen, who had put forward this whole theory. They were all excited about it, assuming, and he was apparently a highly respected person, but he spun out a conspiracy theory that was not much better than Pizzagate. Say it was the doppelganger theory, that she had actually been attacked, but she was attacked by another guy who was at the party who looked like Kavanaugh, and he even named the name of the person, which was terrible, and the guy was had to go into hiding, and, you know, it was a terrible story. In any case, this is really sort of an offshoot of that, saying that Blasey Ford, who said in her testimony that she was 100% certain that it was Kavanaugh, that she'd made a mistake. And I just want to point out that that's just a slightly refined version of what they did with Anita Hill, which David Brock, who was involved in that, has said that they were going to paint her as, quote, a little bit nutty and a little bit slutty. And the idea being that, you know, she's a little crazy and also a little loose. Well, they let go of the loose thing, which I consider progress, 2018.
Right.
Maybe they've learned that calling her a slut was not exactly a good thing. But the nutty part exists, because essentially what they're saying is that this woman who had this traumatic experience, she's too crazy to know who it was. She just doesn't know. She's nuts. She's just fabricated this in her head. It's completely wrong. Now, you know, all the people, the theorists, the psychologists, the legal minds who study the phenomenon of rape culture and how, you know, victims respond, it's not uncommon to forget details, like where the address of the place. But,
right,
you know, this traumatic detail of looking your attacker in the face, somebody that you knew, that was a high school acquaintance, that you'd been at a party, you'd been introduced, you knew the person. No, it makes no sense. So what they're basically saying is that she's a little bit nutty. And that's, you know, there's Susan Collins, our, you know, great protector of women's rights in the Republican Party, basically saying that Christine Blasey Ford is crazy.
And, you know, and we just have a minute here, so I don't want to, but and we can talk more about this in the next hour as we cover more of the news. But I will say this, I'm not so convinced that it's progress as much as the fact that in terms of the a little bit nutty, a little bit slutty, I can't help but think that the fact that Anita Hill was African-American, was a black woman, that they felt the a little bit slutty might sell a little better than, you know, a middle-aged white woman than, you know, a younger black woman at that time. So I'm not quite convinced that we've made that progress. I got to say, I was stunned during the course of those hearings on just how anachronistic these 11 white men on the Republican side of the committee seemed to me, and how out of touch they were. But we can talk more about that in the next hour, because it appears that, contrary to conventional wisdom at the time, that Democrats are, this has, to the extent that there was any hesitancy in terms of Democrats to get out and vote, that is, seems to be gone right now. There is a white hot rage in this country, and, it is completely understandable. We got to take a break. Heather, if you'll join me in the next hour, this is Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back, and Heather will join us in hour two. Just ahead, host of the Amicus podcast, Dahlia Lithwick, on the future of the Supreme Court. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. We do this show, well, just about every week, and you are missing part of it. In fact, you're missing two-thirds of it. By becoming a member, we give you that extra two-thirds of the show you can hear every week. Plus, you have access to our archives. Plus, you keep this show going week in, week out. We got a couple more interviews, more analysis from Digby that are on the other side. So head over to rofpodcast.com, sign up for the full show, become a member. You can pay one annual lump sum or just a couple bucks a week, and you will get the whole show and keep this show chugging along. That's rofpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Brett Kavanaugh has been confirmed to the United States Supreme Court, which leads to a lot of unanswered questions regarding that same court. Here to help us answer some of those questions, Dahlia Lithwick, legal expert for Slate Magazine and host of the Amicus podcast. So, Dahlia, obviously, this week, Brett Kavanaugh was sworn in to be the ninth Supreme Court justice, filling Anthony Kennedy's slot. He had a rather auspicious, I guess, celebration or ceremony with Donald Trump at the White House, where he said that it's the job of a Supreme Court justice to be impartial and nonpartisan, and then went on to thank all the Republicans and the one Democrat who voted for him, which I think perhaps maybe Kavanaugh doesn't know the definition of, you know, being apolitical and nonpartisan. That's quite a concern. Before we get to the gist of your argument that we now need to rely on the other eight justices to temper Brett Kavanaugh, what do you see in a vacuum? When we look at Brett Kavanaugh's track record, what do you see as the biggest implications of him on the court as opposed to Anthony Kennedy?
I mean, it's hard to understate how consequential this would be. I mean, even if you bracket everything that has happened in the last couple of weeks with Dr. Blasey Ford, this will have been the most consequential appointment, you know, of our lifetimes. This is the sort of Nixon-era dream come true, where for the first time you will have a rock-solid 5-4 conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court. This is going to be, I mean, just as a matter of metrics, it will be some of the most conservative jurists who have been seated in the last 100 years will now all be sitting on this court. It will be the first time we have a court in decades where every single conservative was seated by a Republican president, every single liberal was seated by a Democrat. So this is the most political and most partisan court we've ever had. And I think under your question is this real question, and it matters, which is this is going to be the first court in our lifetimes without a swing justice, without somebody like Anthony Kennedy, Sandra Day O'Connor before him, Justice Powell before him, who was in play, who at least had the appearance of the capacity to play for either side depending on what came before the court. And that's gone. So we now have, I mean, just the simple fact is John Roberts will be the, quote, swing vote. He will be at the center of this court. And with one or two exceptions, notably the Affordable Care Act, where John Roberts defected and voted with the liberal branch of the court, he is a movement conservative. He is a rock-solid vote for the Heritage Foundation, for the Federalist Society values. And so I don't know how to put a finer point on it than this. This is simply the fulfillment of the Ed Meese, Nixon, capture the court dream now materialized in front of our eyes.
And so, I mean, major areas, obviously, abortion rights. That doesn't necessarily mean that Roe v. Wade will be overturned, but it does mean that it will be effectively maybe overturned in states that are hostile towards it. So we'll see things like trap laws, the scrutiny applied to what states do in terms of infringing on this right is going to be far less than it used to be when Anthony Kennedy was there. We could see rollbacks on marriage equality rights. But it also seems to me that we're going to see a direct assault, perhaps, on the Chevron doctrine, which basically says that agencies have the expertise in which to promulgate regulations if broadly tasked with that by Congress. We're going to probably see a diminishment on the ability of government to regulate without very, very, very specific directives from Congress.
That's exactly right. I think Brett Kavanaugh is a certain vote for what we've seen as the slow erosion of the regulatory state, a deep suspicion of regulatory agencies on the part of the courts. And I don't think Brett Kavanaugh has made any secret of the fact that he is firmly in the camp that wants to do away with Chevron deference to agencies to set their own rules and agendas. And I think that, you know, in addition to the laundry list you just put forward, I think that some of the other things that are really on the table now, where Anthony Kennedy would have been the decisive fifth vote, are affirmative action in higher education, right, which is probably now on the chopping block. I think gun regulations is an incredibly important area where, you know, the court waded in Heller and then refined it a little bit in McDonald, but has essentially sat silent for years and years while gun regulations more or less won in the lower courts. I think that Kavanaugh's shown a very capacious view of Second Amendment rights, and we're going to see gun laws start to come down. And probably the single most important thing, and again, I don't think Kavanaugh has made any secret of his views on this, are issues around executive power and executive authority and the kind of what our view of the president's authority, whether it's specifics like can the president be investigated or can he be indicted, or fanciful things like can he pardon himself, or just questions that we're going to see, I think, almost inevitably arise around the Mueller probe. All of those issues, Brett Kavanaugh has a very, very, very broad view of executive power and authority, and so I think he would presumably be a fifth vote for that.
So, and I want to get into this idea of how the other justices, you know, can or will or won't influence Kavanaugh, or vice versa, for that matter. But, and I know this is maybe beyond one's ability to predict, but when we look at the Supreme Court, adjudicates somewhere around, they hear about 80 cases a year, if I'm not mistaken. They decide maybe another 50 or so. I don't know how many of the last term when we had Kennedy, we had full complement of justices. You know, how many were 5-4? But are we going to see, and I guess maybe this is a question that speaks to your piece a bit. Are we going to see that much more 5-4s? I mean, was there a certain amount of horse trading that would take place? I mean, so are we going to see exponentially more 5-4 decisions than we would have maybe 3 years ago? Because maybe in some instances, a Breyer or a Ginsburg or a Kagan would say, I'm going to vote to make this 6-3 or 7-2, because maybe down the road it will build a relationship with a specific judge in a specific area of the law that I'll be able to swing them onto my side. Is that how it happens in the court? Do we know?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a good question, Sam. And I think, you know, there's this famous story that is told that Justice Brennan every year used to ask his clerks, like, what is the single most important constitutional principle of all? And the answer was, get to 5. You know, just right. You need 5 votes. That's the only thing that matters. And I've seen some interesting chatter suggesting that, you know, you're certainly right. And particularly in this last term, we saw Elena Kagan and Steve Breyer try to find middle positions in a whole bunch of cases that looked like they were, whether it's explicitly horse trading or cultivating relationships or playing some kind of long game, trying to get Anthony Kennedy to peel off and clump with them. And we saw that in a few instances. I've seen some interesting theorizing that says, good, now they're freed up. They can become, you know, full-throated liberal dissenters they were born to be, and they don't have to try to play this game of getting to five. Now, I don't know that that's the case. I think sort of by temperament, both Breyer and Kagan tend to be moderates who try to hive off narrow things and decide as little as possible. Certainly, Elena Kagan has said in the last few weeks that her view of the court and these legitimacy questions around the court in this polarized moment is that it really turns on the Chief Justice, on John Roberts, to do minimalist, centrist, very narrow, very cabined decisions so as to more or less stay out of the headlines. And she, it's almost like she threw down the gauntlet and said, John Roberts, you've done this before when we had a 4-4 court and everybody was watching. You know how to do this, and you're going to have to do it again.
That's fascinating. All right, well, let's take a quick break. I'll be right back with Dahlia Lithwick on the implications of Brett Kavanaugh being sworn in as the 9th justice on the Supreme Court. Be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Hey, folks, Mike Papantonio's new book entitled Law and Vengeance, which is the follow-up to his critically acclaimed novel Law and Disorder, is finally out and available to you to buy. The book is a legal and political thriller drawing on Pap's experience both as a skilled trial lawyer and as a nationally syndicated political talk show host. The story follows trial lawyer Gina Romano, who was first introduced in Law and Disorder, on her quest for both vengeance and justice in a whistleblower lawsuit against a weapons manufacturer who developed and sold a dangerously defective rifle scope. Papp has built a story around real-life events that he's encountered as one of the top trial lawyers in America, where he's been fighting some of the world's largest and most corrupt corporations. Buy Mike Papantonio's new book, Law and Vengeance, today. Go to www.lawandvengeance.com. That's lawandvengeance.com. Check it out. I know you're going to love it. We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking to Slate Magazine's Dahlia Lithwick about her piece, Only the Seated Supreme Court Justices Can Save Us Now. So Dahlia, at the break, I mean, we're obviously talking about the implications of Brett Kavanaugh on the court. In the last segment, you walked us through the areas in the law, and there's many. I don't know about all. We didn't get to maritime law, but certainly, in all of the major aspects of the law that touch our lives on a daily basis, Brett Kavanaugh, you called his ascension to the court as probably the most significant addition to the court in our lifetimes. And so at the break, you also mentioned that Elena Kagan had basically thrown down the gauntlet, had said more or less publicly, paraphrasing here, to John Roberts, the best thing you can do to maintain the integrity of the institution of the Supreme Court is to take cases that are not going to be divisive, that are not going to be singular in their impact on our society, that are understated in such a way that this raw, naked divide on our court is de-emphasized. Let's say John Roberts is also having a conversation with, I don't know, with Thomas or Alito, and they're saying, hey, now's the time to fulfill your destiny and, you know, return us to the Lochner era. And what if he goes down the middle? Like, what do you anticipate? Is Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, are they going to be best buddies? I mean, they were basically raised together, it feels like. I mean, literally, I think went to all the same schools. What can we anticipate when you're saying the only thing that could mitigate this situation is that only the seated Supreme Court justices can save us now? How would that, what would that look like? And if so, who would be the drivers of that?
Well, you know, here's what it's not going to look like. People have these very sweet notions that maybe Elena Kagan would just like refuse to talk to him, you know, that Sonia Sotomayor would pick up her tray and sit at another table, you know, that there would be some kind of pushback. That's for sure not going to happen. And we already saw that, you know, this morning already Kavanaugh was seated for his first oral argument and people are joking and laughing. And that is how it should be. This is an incredibly collegial, warm court. Nobody is going to perform political umbrage. So whatever folks are thinking when they think that he's going to get frozen out, you know, and not get invited to like birthday parties, that's clearly not going to happen. The court is working double time to show that they are not a partisan riven institution. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think that of the justices you just mentioned, John Roberts is probably the one who, as an institutionalist, as somebody who, like his mentor before him, Chief Justice William Rehnquist, thinks about the court first and public perceptions of the court. That's what keeps him up at night. And that's probably why he voted with the left in the Affordable Care Act cases. It's why he was very, very careful not to say or do anything partisan, both during the Merrick Garland vacancy and this summer when Donald Trump was picking a new nominee. So I think that it is sort of descriptively right to say that John Roberts is going to do everything he can to avoid, even if Clarence Thomas is whispering in his ear, you know, touchdown dance, let's overturn Roe tomorrow. I think John Roberts is very savvy. He's also very young, and he can afford to string this out over a decade. And so I think what you're going to see is a concerted effort across the boards for the court to kick away some of the really, really hot button cases, to decide things narrowly in exactly the way Elena Kagan has recommended, to keep itself off the front pages in the coming months, and to signal that the court is, in fact, this apolitical third branch of government dedicated to the rule of law. Now, there are a couple of caveats to that. One is at the swearing-in that you just described, in addition to what Brett Kavanaugh said, we had Donald Trump calling Dr. Blasey Ford, you know, saying that was a hoax,
right,
saying that Kavanaugh had been, quote, proven innocent. Nothing of the sort happened. So Donald Trump isn't helping in this effort. He's working very hard to undermine the idea of the court as nonpartisan. And I think the other thing that is really important is that we get very focused on whether the court is going to do things in this big way or a little way. It, as you said, around abortion rights, it can do it in a little way and still inflict tremendous damage. And so I think, you know, whether John Roberts like ends the what's left of the voting right tomorrow or ends what's left of the voting right by a thousand of the Voting Rights Act by a thousand cuts, that's where we're going.
And so what about, let me ask you this. I mean, this is sort of, I guess just a loose end. But the D.C. Court of Appeals forwarded to John Roberts after Merrick Garland basically recused himself and another judge assessed the validity of the claims, basically sent, some reports to John Roberts of complaints about Brett Kavanaugh, essentially saying, hey, the guy lied during his, I mean, the judge didn't make this assessment, but others, but she deemed them credible enough to be forwarded. What does John Roberts do with that stuff? He just sits on that in the same way that he sat on the idea that Clarence Thomas's wife, Ginny, you know, would represent in many regards a conflict of interest in some cases in the past. Does he do anything with that stuff? Or does he let Brett Kavanaugh know, like, hey, I got a folder, so just take it easy? I mean, what happens?
Well, I think it's really important to be clear. Those are two different things. I think people forget, or maybe they don't know, that John Roberts doesn't have ethics authority over the other eight justices. And so John Roberts can't go to Clarence Thomas and say, hey, you have to recuse yourself on any case in which, you know, your wife and her political right. actions were, you know, animating figures. That's Clarence Thomas's decision alone. And this has been a decades-long ethics problem, that the canons of judicial ethics apply to all federal judges except the nine justices on the Supreme Court. They make their own determinations about recusal. And that's why, by the way, because a lot of groups are now saying, I don't think that I want Brett Kavanaugh to be, who, you know, was yelling about the Clintons and dark money,
right,
to sit in front of me and adjudicate issues that I'm going to be involved in. That's not going to be John Roberts' call. Brett Kavanaugh will make the call about whether he recuses in those matters. And that is really just an ongoing and, I think, non-trivial ethics problem that the court has, that the justices are the arbiters of their own ethics rules. As to what John Roberts is going to do with Brett Kavanaugh, you know, probably not a lot. I think they agree on the merits on about 90% of the cases that are going to come before them. And where they may disagree is just these questions of tone and temperament that we're discussing. And so, you know, it is entirely possible that if Brett Kavanaugh is as angry as I suspect he will be in the wake of these hearings, and he writes something snarky in an opinion, John Roberts will say, eh, that could come out. That's how he will try to modulate things. But in terms of having any real authority, no, I think it's Brett Kavanaugh's call. Yep.
Dahlia Lithwick, thanks so much for your insight. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Sam.
Dahlia Lithwick writes about the courts and the law for Slate and hosts the podcast Amicus. When we come back, Heather Digby Parton will join us to analyze more news from the past week. That's just ahead. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Check out ROFpodcast.com to support the show.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.